Hey there, John McWhorter.
Len Lowry.
Welcome to the Glenn Show, John. I'm really glad to be talking to you.
Thanks for having me back.
Not at all, man. You're a mainstay. In fact, you're hard to get, John. Why do you play hard to get like that?
No, it's not hard to get. It's, you know, this is the first time in 10 years I've been teaching two courses a semester, and I am finding that I'm a little out of practice in juggling that plus everything else, so I'm getting a little absent-minded. Sorry about that.
Looks like you have to work for a living for a change.
Yeah, I actually have to work to eat, but that's what's going on lately. So I've joined the real world once again.
Well, my scheduling assistant, who happens to be me, tells me that it takes 3 or 4 calls to get you hooked up for one of these conversations.
So. Well, for this one in particular, and I apologize for that.
No, but that's all right. You're worth it. You're worth working hard to get you on. So, we're the black guys at BloggingHeads.tv, and it falls to us to talk about the role of race in this campaign, if any. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be one of our topics today, along with breaking news. Mitt Romney overheard speaking earlier in the year at a fundraiser for his campaign and writing off 47% of the electorate as not being worth his time to solicit their votes or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that. And I don't think we can get away without at least saying a few words about what's going on over in North Africa and in the Middle East and throughout the Islamic world, protests against an offensive video that's been released and demonstrations against the United States that have resulted in the death of our ambassador in Libya and other things. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
That's our agenda.
That's right.
How are you doing, by the way? How's life? How's the baby?
The baby is very good. She's adorable, as always, and she very much recognizes her two parents, which is very gratifying. And at Columbia, I'm doing the Western Civ core curriculum and Introduction to Linguistics at the same time, so I'm shifting gears wildly and enjoying it. I have forgotten how much fun it is to have this much structured schedule. You know, I'm pretty good at cranking stuff out on my own. All of a sudden, now I have to be somewhere at somebody else's behest all the time. I kind of like it. How are you?
I guess I'm getting by, John. I'm sort of limping along. I'm not going to give you a sad song here. I'm doing okay. I can't really complain. Classes have started, and it is good to be busy and embedded again in this flow of activity.
Embedded, that's right.
You know, that does feel pretty good. I had a terrific summer, I must say. Traveled to South Korea, as you know. Traveled to South Asia, as you know. And had a family reunion where my five children and, four of my five children and five of my six grandchildren gathered for a week last month in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania to commiserate the Lowry family reunion. Man, I'm a patriarch. You know?
Well, that must feel weird.
It does feel absolutely weird, but it was such a delight to have my son, Alden, who's a journalist in Chicago, and his three children and his wife, and my daughter, Lisa, and her two boys. They live in suburban D.C., and my two sons, Glenn and Nehemiah. Unfortunately, their mother passed away last year, and, you know, in a way we were honoring and remembering her by coming together. It was just wonderful to be surrounded by my children and grandchildren, and we just had a great, great time. I have tons of photos, John. Go to my Facebook page, you know. No, so I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling okay, I guess. Thanks for asking. Let's get on with the business at hand. So now, you must have seen Ta-Nehisi Coates' long essay published in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly.
I did.
Under the title, Fear of a Black President.
Yeah.
And one thing that race guys like you and I have to do is periodically assess, you know, the racial temper of national politics and this and that. What do you think about Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece, and what more generally is your thinking these days about the role, if any, of race, racial resentment, racial loyalty, whatever it might be, racial stigma, stereotyping, whatever, race card playing, strategic uses of race, race signaling to the electorate, you know, dog whistle use. What's, not to put words in your mouth, but what's your thought about that?
You know what I think about that? I think that the general orthodoxy about it among what you might call right-thinking people neglects the issue of degree. And so the issue is Obama received to some extent based on his race? Yes, of course. But I think that Ta-Nehisi's article and its implication that Obama's race has been a major aspect of his reception in the story of the last 4 years, I think it's inaccurate. And it's interesting because I duct something which I usually don't. You know, if there's one thing that I seem to be kind of known for, it's enjoying controversy, and I suppose I do. But I was asked to be on MSNBC's Chris Hayes Up with Chris Hayes show, which I do pretty regularly.
Thought you said you'd do Chris Hayes whenever he called.
Except this time. It was with Ta-Nehisi and with Melissa Harris-Perry. And I thought about it, and I decided I know what one is supposed to think on that particular show about this particular issue with that particular article out in the Atlantic right now. And I just thought, I don't feel comfortable putting myself on a stage for 2 hours with Ta-Nehisi Coates, with whom I've had my differences, and with Melissa, who, you know, she's very cordial with me, but she thinks of me as, you know, a certain something. And I just thought, I can't, I decided I can't take the risk of being perceived that negatively for two straight hours.
Well, but hold on, John. Okay, I hear you. You didn't want to do the show, and you stated your reasons, but I just got to tell you this. Melissa Harris-Perry thinks everybody is a certain something. She thinks Cornel West is a certain something.
That's true.
She thinks Orlando Patterson is a certain something. She thinks Glenn Lowry is a certain something. And excuse me, but I'm entertaining the hypothesis that all black males who are not married to her in Melissa Harris-Perry's mind are a little certain something that need to be told off. Okay? She's in the telling black men off business. Okay, there, I've said it. Go ahead, Melissa. Have at me.
Yeah. Well, she's a controversialist herself, and I know that she's had problems with quite a few people. I don't know what you mean. I don't know her as somebody who is anti-male in particular. Maybe if I knew more about her, I'd see it. I see her as having had some problems with Cornel West because of what happened with Princeton, and I don't know how she feels about Orlando Patterson. I imagine his quote-unquote conservative strain would alienate her, and I know that's how she feels about some of my statements along those lines. She's never attacked me, but I just felt that on that stage, I'm taking the risk of being made a fool of because I thought no matter what I say, I'm going to be seen as just an apostate rather than just feeling that as history will be written about the Obama experience so far. I just don't think that his race has played a significant part. Would you agree?
No, but I would not agree with Harris-Perry, and I don't think I agree altogether with Coates.
Mm-hmm.
I think his race is playing a big part, but not in the way that they say.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
They say racist America, they won't give him a chance. Everybody is hemming him in and tying him down because of race and, you know, whatever. And I think I share your view that we ought to be slow, not quick, to interpret events in that way, in that classical patterns of sort of white racist denigration or withdrawal of cooperation from African Americans are not operative here.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think there's a subtext. I think it's a little bit more subtle. I think there's a kind of subliminal thing that's going on with race that that does affect him in interesting ways. Okay, so for example, he did not go and speak to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People this summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an attack on Obama. He didn't go, all right? He says, or they say, scheduling difficulties. I say malarkey.
Mm-hmm.
I say optics difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Optics difficulties are a crowd of cheering left liberal black people embracing their black president is exactly what Mr. Obama does not want.
Mm-hmm.
The swing voters of Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, et cetera.
Certainly.
Okay? So this is a way in which race is affecting him, although not, as I say, a kind of straightforward repeat of the 1950s,
sure,
no blacks need apply racism, something that's a little bit more subtle than that.
Mm-hmm.
Neither he nor the Republican candidate are willing to talk, and we're going to say something more about the Republican candidate in a moment, are willing to talk at all about poverty. You've got Cornel West and Tevis Smiley now touring the country on their poverty tour, trying to raise the profile of the issue. And I just looked at the numbers recently, man. The poverty numbers are going up and up and up. This is a serious long-term recession.
Serious.
Serious long-term recession that has wreaked havoc in the bottom 20% of the population. Now, the president, a Democrat, a liberal Democrat,
mm-hmm,
is saying very little about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be the case no matter who.
I was going to say, John Edwards would be the same way right now. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is I think Obama has less wiggle room. I mean, I think he really has to worry about being labeled the food stamp president.
Mm-hmm.
He really has to worry
about
it seeming that he's advocating for the people who are dependent upon government, not for the people who are the job creators and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more so for him because he's black. This is just me thinking that those kind of attacks, which could be leveled at any Democrat, have a greater chance of sticking on this Democrat because he's black. So, I mean, I just think race is in the mix here, definitely in the mix.
Certainly not.
And I should say, by the way, that the Obama camp are not above exploiting sort of subliminal racial aspects of our political culture to their own advantage by, you know, suggesting sometimes not so subtly that one or another criticism or attack on them is motivated by some kind of invidious racial
Michelle
motive.
Obama has struck that note, right?
Yeah,
I think
so. That's what I'm thinking.
And I think one thing that has to be said is that to feel, yeah, certainly race plays a role, but if we're more specific, has Obama's presidency been hobbled or significantly colored by white people's biases, subliminal or overt, against black people? I think that in terms of what the history books will say, the answer is not what a Ta-Nehisi Coates, to use him as a generic concept, would say. So, for example, we can all know. I remember the moment, and I'm sure you remember it too, when Obama is trying to make his first significant speech as president, and Republican Joe Wilson, white from South Carolina, yells out, "You lie." I remember the moment, and I remember turning to my wife and saying, "Who in the world just yelled that out?" Now, was that informed somewhat by race? We can't put electrodes on his head, but I say yes. Yeah, I highly doubt that if John Edwards had been making that speech, Joe Wilson would have yelled, "You lie." I feel it in my guts as an American black person of these times. Yeah, but the issue though is degree. Does Joe Wilson and little things like that signify that Obama has been stubbing his toe on racism everywhere he goes? And I say there's no evidence for that.
Yeah, okay, degree, and then it gets subjective, and it's very hard to draw a line. But let me ask you this. So one of Coates's points, one of the anecdotes that he uses to drive the narrative of his essay, has to do with the statement that Obama made after the Trayvon Martin killing created a national furor.
Mm-hmm.
And the president, in some context, addressed himself to the matter saying, and I believe this is a quote, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon.
Right.
Okay? And what he did then was to personalize something that had been a kind of, you know, political and maybe to some degree policy matter, and to racialize it implicitly. He called attention to his own blackness from the powerful office of chief executive and sort of presiding officer of the American executive government. And he said, you know, the guy looks like me, basically, and I'm, you know, therefore, you know, especially sensitive, aware of, you know, attuned to the concerns that people have raised in this regard. And a ton of bricks fell on him from the right for having said that. You see, the president's a racist. You see, the president's playing a race card. You see, the president favors black people. And what Colt said, and I do think this is true, is that, you know, we elect people and they occupy these offices and they do the job, but they're not just functionaries. They're also embodiments of us and of us and all of our diversity. Okay? So if there's a Southerner up there speaking with a twang in his voice, that means something to people who speak like that. And if there's somebody from my religious group who is ascending to the highest office, whether it be a Mormon or one day it will be a Jew who occupies that office, that will mean something. That will resonate. And when the person conducts the office and carries out the ceremonial function, when the first family assembles for an Easter egg hunt on the White House lawn, when they solemnly preside over the returning of the remains of American military people who have died in the line of duty and so on, in their person, they embody something, they inflect something, they connote and convey something subtly about the nature of the country. And Colt's point is, many people are not comfortable with an African-American who has a little bit of a swagger, who is hip, who is black, okay, carrying out the grand functions of American government and at the same time bringing into those functions kind of the tone, the kind of style, the you know, cultural resonant, resonating with this element of America. And I have to tell you, John, I think there's something to that, man. I mean, I watched the South Side of Chicago become a caricature in the 2008 campaign because of Jeremiah Wright and all this other stuff, from which it has never recovered. We now have a president of the United States who is from the South Side of Chicago, but you wouldn't know it. You know what I mean? Do you understand what I'm saying? He's a Chicago. The narrative is he's a Chicago politician. You know, he's got more in common with the Richard Daley's or the Rahm Emanuels than he does with the 1 million plus African Americans who live south of Madison Avenue in Chicago, Illinois, which constitutes a world. And it's a world from which Barack Obama has arisen, which to a certain degree he embodies. His wife was born and bred in that world, and it's been denatured. It's, you know, it's been neutered, denatured, stripped of all of its specificity, because America's not ready to hear that aspect of its own voice. Something like that. I'm sorry if I sound like Melissa, but,
I think, for one thing, I think we have to qualify what we mean by America, because I think that's not true of America. That's true of some people, and people with rather loud voices. And more to the point, there are some people who are uncomfortable with a bit of swagger in the White House, with the idea that a black person is going to be the one in charge and telling them what to do. Sure, I don't think that surprises anybody. We knew that from the beginning. But the proper response to that, given the grander nature of things, I think is, descriptively, that's true. Fox News is not going away. Bigoted white people aren't going away. But the issue is degree. Ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, and I don't mean to be dismissive, Glenn, but I really do think that the following two words are the answer. Who cares? I mean, sure, you can go document the things that people are going to say in columns, especially on the internet at this point. So if Obama says something sympathetic and identifying with about Trayvon Martin, a certain kind of person is going to say, there he goes with the race stuff again. But really, who cares? And this is why we need
to... I care, John.
But wait, Glenn. This is why I'm saying who cares. Look at the fact that he's about to be reelected. And I feel safe enough, especially today, in saying that that's what's going to happen. All these things have been said.
No,
he's going to be. I'll eat my words if he isn't. But all of those things have been said. And yet here we are, and the man is actually almost certainly going to have another 4 years, which is to say that, life isn't fair. Life is going to knock you around. But has it gotten him out of office? Has it kicked him out of office? And if it hasn't, then I'm more interested in the more general story of his rather mediocre presidency and how he might be able to improve it as we go on. I just see the whole racial aspect of it, to obsess over it and to call it the fear of a black presidency, although Coates maybe did not give it that title. It's applying an 80s, 70s lens to a much more complicated modern reality.
Okay, John, I got your message. I see where you're coming from. I don't agree. Who cares? So I care. The president, when has he mentioned, I don't know how this is going to sound, when has he mentioned slavery? Okay, when has the president talked about slavery? I guess there's not a lot to say, is there? anyway, never mind. Forget it. I'm sorry I even mentioned it.
No.
Okay, let's move on to the next
topic. It's important. It's a very important discussion to have. And I'm
okay, here, let me put it like this. You have a Passover Seder at the White House. Mm-hmm. That's all about slavery, the enslavement by the Egyptians of the Jews, the deliverance of the historic Jewish people from bondage and so forth and so on. Okay, but the black president of the United States cannot address the legacy of slavery in the United States of America that casts a shadow all the way into the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Would you be satisfied if he did it in the next 4 years?
Yeah, that would help.
because maybe he wasn't going to do that when it would have possibly put his being real at risk. Although I don't think it would have, to be honest. I think some people would have said some things, and largely...
I don't even know what I'm talking about, man. I withdraw. I think I'm probably over the top here. Let's move on to safer ground. The next topic, which was Mitt Romney thinking that 47% of the electorate, or maybe it's 46%, according to Timothy Noah this morning, don't pay federal income taxes. Mm-hmm. They get benefits from the government. They are dependent on the government. They're not exhibiting initiative. I'm not quoting. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. They're not going to vote for a Republican candidate who wants to cut taxes because they have no benefit from getting their taxes cut after all. They're not paying any.
Mm-hmm.
He's got those people. I'm not worried about them, says candidate Romney.
He says it's not his job to worry about them, right?
It's not my job to worry about them. I'm going to try to get these swing voters in the middle who should be disappointed with the president. And you called it mediocre. Isn't that what you just got to be saying?
Which mediocre?
I thought you said that President Obama's performance in the first.
Oh yes.
Did you just say that? So candidate Romney is saying I'm going to try to use that fact to woo voters in the middle, but I'm not going to get these 47% of whatever it is who are dependent on the public fisc for their sustenance. Now, a ton of bricks has fallen on candidate
Glenn,
Romney for having
said that. What was that word you just used? Public what?
Fisc. FISC.
I never knew that was a word. Go ahead.
That's a word, man. Check it out.
Well, I learned a word today. Okay, go ahead.
Is the noun. You learned that in Econ 101, John. I guess you didn't take that, huh?
I actually didn't. Fisk. Okay. I'm going to keep that.
Take economics, my man.
I read about it.
Anyway, what do you think about the flap over Romney's purported gaffe?
Yeah. What do you think?
Okay. Look, I'm not going to vote for Mitt Romney. I want you and everybody listening to know that. I'm going to vote for Barack Hussein Obama. Okay? Mm-hmm. I think as I watch this campaign that Romney is deeply hampered by the fact that the press are hostile, by and large, and looking for an excuse to foster a narrative that says Romney's a loser, Romney is unfit, Romney is this caricature of a person, this, that, and the other. I think when I compare the coverage that I've seen so far in this sort of 36-hour window to the way in which Obama's famous comment during the 2008 campaign about the white working class voters in places like Pennsylvania who wouldn't vote for him because they were clinging to their guns and their religion and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struck by the sort of universal condemnation and lack of any kind of qualifying tone in the coverage of this on Romney, who's being pilloried left, right, and center mm-hmm. for both running an incompetent campaign and for the substance of what he had said.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was that bad is what I'm saying, okay? I am not agreeing with the comment. I'm mm-hmm. just saying I think that the negative reception of it is overblown and is, in my mind, an indication of the subtle bias against his candidacy that inhabits the people who have their hands on the levers of public communication in the country. On the mm-hmm. substance of it, I think it's true that the political implications of the growth of the welfare state is to build in a certain momentum on behalf of the party that brands itself as defenders of the welfare state. And I believe that it's true that there are, over the long term, definite tendency for this kind of reinforcing political dynamic to work, which is you legislate benefits, the set of people who get those benefits become loyal to the party that has produced those benefits, and that enhances the political leverage of that party. I don't think there's any if defense contractors or venture capitalists or small business people who might be inclined to go Republican do so in part because they understand the philosophy of that party to reinforce and amplify their own personal interests, then the same thing is going to be true at the other end of the ideological spectrum. So I think there's some merit in that. I think as a matter of political strategy, however, he was speaking to fundraiser, to a loyalist, just as Obama had been in 2008, didn't think that what he was saying there was going to be publicly broadcast, wouldn't have said it that way if he had known. But, of course, in this era of the smartphone and all of that, everybody has to assume everything that they say everywhere is going to be known. And I think as a matter of political strategy, a statement like that is definitely very harmful to him. So that's what I think.
I don't know. I think as of this one, I can't even pretend to consider him what's called a serious man, and I think that it's a tragic symptom of the Republican Party establishment such as it is, that the best person they could come up with even a semblance of the gravitas to become the actual candidate, would be someone of this timber who would say, during what many economists, and you would know better than me, but many economists would call a depression, during a depression would call people, many of whom are those who have been put out of work by this depression and are having a really hard time, people who are sucking on the public, I'll use the word this time myself, fisc. And you're talking about this 47 to 46%. Couldn't he have given a little thought beforehand to who these people are? And we won't even get into that a lot of them, as we've heard, are the kinds of people who actually vote Republican. Really, he's talking about the old and the poor and the down on their luck. It requires, it displays such a lack of foresight, such a lack of compassion. And I really think that ultimately he just bumbles into these things because he enjoys standing in a room and saying the things that he thinks are going to get him praised because he wants to be president just because he wants to be king, it's harder and harder for me to see exactly what this man really wants to do. And as of this, I frankly think that this pretty much probably deep sixes his candidacy. That's why I was so confident a few minutes ago.
Oh, please.
Obama has it. I'm not alone in this. And I'm really disappointed in the man because I wasn't going to vote for him either. But there's a hollow suit there. I can barely think of a recent candidate who really had this little to say, this little core, even if that core was factually wrong sometimes. I just see it's a nasty, airheaded, not to mention unwise thing to say in this era of internet. This is worse than his welfare Obama comments, where he was implying that the Obama administration wants to put more people on welfare when factually it's clear that they didn't. This is even worse. I'm appalled. Absolutely appalled.
Okay, John, we agree to disagree about this one, too. Not a serious man. Mitt Romney is not a serious man.
No. No, I don't think so. Even as somebody who is a leading member of a religion which is under threat in such a way that
not a serious man. He's been governor of Massachusetts. He built a business and made a fortune. He's not a serious man.
No, he would have been a serious man.
Not a serious man?
When he was governor of Massachusetts. But look at the way he's disavowed it just so he could become king. I don't see him as somebody with any kind of
process. You just drunk the Kool-Aid, John. This is like the Obama campaign narrative. Do you get the memos? Is that it?
No, but I don't see why you don't agree. I don't think that he's a serious man.
I do not agree. He's vastly more qualified for the office on the basis of his life experience today than was the current incumbent when he occupied the office for the first time 4 years ago.
I grant you that.
He's done a great deal in his life. I don't know how you can say he's not serious. Now, you may say you're not going to vote for him. I just said I wasn't going to vote for him. You may, I think, correctly observe that he has not articulated any kind of sort of consistent and coherent, passionately expressed, deeply felt, clearly thought, crisply conveyed vision about what he wants to do in the office. Okay, mm-hmm. So there is a kind of resume feeling. I've been the best at everything, and I'm going to become president of the United States. That's the highest prize you can get to grasp that ring, and I'm going to do it. Element to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I will buy that, and that is a deficiency of the candidate. I'm not voting for him. I just got to be saying that. I'll say it for the third time. But not a serious man. Come on.
No.
And this statement doesn't render him unserious, no more so than Barack Hussein Obama's statement during the 2008 campaign rendered him too arrogant, aloof, and snobbish and contemptuous of the working class non-minorities of the country to be the chief executive. That too is a caricature foisted for partisan purposes. So I see this about Romney as a caricature. Comments taken out of context when he didn't know that he was going to be overheard or whatever, speaking to Confederates months and months ago, released at this critical point in the campaign. Come on, man.
You
have to agree to disagree about that.
You realize that by serious man, I mean in capital SM, I mean what we might call a mensch, somebody with certain core principles, somebody with some sort of nucleus. Barack Obama was an underqualified candidate who was a serious man, which you can see from his autobiography. He had principles, he's had to break some. But you knew there was a there. I'm not seeing that with Romney. I wouldn't have said this in 1994, but it's appalling to me how transparently he's let all of it go just so he can be king. And I don't think we can say this one is taken out of context. That man really does lack a certain heart, because he's talking about people who are really hurting. Not to mention that he's just plain stupid. He hasn't even done his homework, and he was on the ropes even in May. I just don't see him as somebody who we can take seriously as a candidate for high office. You see what I mean by serious man there?
I see what you mean. I still don't agree with you, John, and I'm prepared to move on, but, okay.
Okay, let's do the Middle East.
No, I see what you mean. You say he's not a mensch. You say he doesn't have a soul. You say that he'll say anything to get elected. You say that who knows what he believes in, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I say he has gotten himself the nomination in what is an increasingly conservative party, being a relatively moderate Republican, all things considered, having, as I say, gotten elected and performed adequately as chief executive of a fairly liberal and Democratic-leaning state, and having then had to, as it were, reinvent himself in order to be able to compete effectively in this very conservative party, who hasn't done a very good job in this campaign of recalibrating yet again and forcefully projecting kind of, what his governing philosophy would be, and therefore hasn't earned my vote. But still, I'm going to call him a serious man, and you're not. And these conclusions about him lacking a heart, I mean, I don't know what they would be based upon. I mean, you glided very quickly past the role that he plays within his church. I take that really seriously, and I think it's quite significant that someone is a leader within their civic community, as well as being a leader in the public affairs and a leader in the business world and so on. Not a serious man? No. A man we don't know yet? Yeah, I'll say that much.
I have to
add, we don't know him.
I'm not impressed by him being a leader in his church. He was born to that, and it's very deeply inbred in Mormon culture to take a more active part in religion than many people take in theirs. He didn't know anything different. Good for him. But in terms of what he's doing,
he can't get credit for actually living a life in service to other people. It's like the inheritance. It doesn't reflect on his character. It just reflects on the community from which he comes.
As a Mormon, I'm less impressed. No, they are a very serious religion. To be a Mormon is much more engulfing than for most people to be a Baptist. So I'm not.
But I'm not saying that's a characteristic of the person, whether it comes from his community identity or not. It's something that he takes with him wherever he goes, right? I mean, that element of him is a mensch, even if the menschness is derived from having been raised as a Mormon, I would say.
Have had a column coming out in me for a while that I keep forgetting to write, where I say, what kind of Mormon is this? Because, yeah, he's devoting his life to service, and then he comes out into the public sphere and becomes this callow huckster. And you're saying he hasn't articulated a vision, but isn't it obvious that he doesn't even have one and has forgotten to even pretend to? I'm just surprised. It's inconsistent to me. Not a serious man.
You've said it for the fourth time. That doesn't make it any more true, John. Okay? We disagree. Let's move on.
Okay.
To our final topic of this lovely conversation, which is embassy burning, ambassador assassinating, feverish crowds, vituperating, if that's a word.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm going to look it up as soon as we get off the air.
I'm already thinking. I don't think it is, but it should be. Yeah.
It should be. And so forth and so on, man. What are we to make of this furious reaction in the Islamic world? To a film that insults the Prophet Muhammad and their religion, the anti-American character of it. Does it in fact reveal that your president's, my president too, but your president's policies with respect to resetting American relations with the Arab world were born in naivete and failed to take the full measure of the alienation from the American political and national enterprise of this vast swath of humanity? What are your thoughts there? I'm just curious.
Well, I think what we're seeing is something that's just going to keep happening again and again until we have a profound recalibration of conditions in that world in terms of geopolitics, in terms of opportunities available, particularly to young men, because these are people who feel that they have a right not to have the Prophet Muhammad insulted. It's an interesting characterization of rights. Their sense is that that is completely off the table, that there would be any question that they would allow that sort of thing to happen. And our notion of free speech and the government allowing this sort of thing to be, say, on the internet, that doesn't work for them, and I don't think that there's any conversation to be had. They have a sense of honor being primary that for us is alien. And we can't stop idiots from making videos and from drawing cartoons, and people are not going to stop doing that. And I think that the people in question are going to continue to see these things as profound and intolerable abuses. And the idea of don't they understand the First Amendment fails. Well, I was thinking about this just a few days ago. Stanley Fish says better than me in the New York Times today. So I think we're stuck at this point, and maybe a lot of the people who are so upset about these things would have less time to vituperate, and I just looked it up, and that is a word, so that's two today. They would have less time to vituperate and maybe could let certain things roll off of them if they had more to think about in their lives. That's my guess, that a certain basic alienation is part of what we might see as an overreaction to insult, but I don't think anything can be fixed on this one. We're stuck with very different ways of looking at the world and what it is to be a person. What about you?
I think that last sentence of yours, we're stuck with very different ways of looking at the world and what it means to be a person, is spot on. It's the implications of the fact that we are in this condition, that is, we human beings are in this condition of inhabiting a global complex of civilizations across the divisions of which certain ideas do not travel. It's the implications of that that I'm not entirely clear on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have been very interested in this controversy because... and it echoes the Salman Rushdie, satanic verses when he publishes the novel and a fatwa is issued on him and he has to go into hiding mm-hmm. for years. And the reaction to those cartoons published in a Danish newspaper that depicted the Prophet Muhammad. And it reminds me of the debate back during the culture wars of the 1980s about the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, they gave a small grant that supported the work of a man called Robert Mapplethorpe,
mm-hmm.
A man who was gay.
Homoerotic, yeah.
Yeah, he made homoerotic art, amongst other things. One of his works had a crucifix sitting in a beaker of yellow liquid.
It's called Piss Christ.
Piss Christ. And he had put the crucifix in something he invited us to see as urine, mm-hmm. this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And... the debate was not that – the debate within the United States about that was not that he shouldn't be able to do it. It was that public money shouldn't be going to support him doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very clear that – I'm talking about Mapplethorpe now. That work of art was a work of art, okay? And that act of speech, that is the image that he projected, was a piece of social criticism that it would have been horrific to imagine could not be expressed within our society.
Mm-hmm.
You can criticize religion, and it's a good thing too. Okay. And we've worked this out within liberalism in the West to a pretty high degree. I mean, if you go and pick up John Stuart Mill's essay written in, I think, 1860 or 1861 on liberty,
mm-hmm.
and you read there his defense of an atheist's right to be able to voice their non-belief publicly, mm-hmm. even in a society in which the vast majority of people are offended by that statement and believe,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you sort of see the core of his idea. This is a profoundly important development.
The idea that it's a benefit to be able to debate it, even if almost everybody considers it wrong. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Exactly. That's the idea. The idea that even the truth, the vitality of the truth is enhanced by refuting the heretic.
Mm-hmm.
You want to allow the heretic to speak, even if he's speaking falsehoods, because the act of refuting him strengthens and enriches your own belief. And, you know, so this is an advance, this kind of idea, and the instantiation of institutions, the creation of institutions that embody this idea and protect this idea.
Oh, you feel it's an advance?
I feel the...
That's a loaded statement.
The advent of a philosophically robust understanding that then gets enshrined in law and civic practice of the idea that people ought to be free to express themselves even when they say the most unpopular things. Not shouting, not the incitement, not shouting fire in a crowded theater, that kind of thing. And this, well, could have been ultimately an act of incitement, the controversy that we're talking about with this anti-Islamic film. But this idea that free speech is a prized value at the center of our collective life, I think that's an advancement. Yes, I do.
Well, I'm not comfortable saying that anymore because so very many people don't agree with this. And if we call it, I'm being coy, but if we call it an advancement, then we're calling these Muslim societies backwards, right? We've gone further than them.
To the extent that their anti-blasphemy laws persecute people for expressing criticisms of the religion that the majority embraces, I regard that as an aspect of political backwardness, not dissimilar from, to the extent that their laws inhibit the equal participation in public life of people who happen to be women, constitutes a backward element that we within the Western sphere have ourselves in relatively recent history progress toward overcoming.
So it's not about diversity. It's that we have had an insight, especially since the 1600s, that they have not been privy to, and they might benefit from doing things more our way.
I don't like the we and the our, although I know I've invited that with my own formulation. I wouldn't try to make the separation so stark. I don't think there's anything essentialist about it. You know, there's something in the drinking water of the West that makes us superior and so forth. But yes, I think that the evolution of political understanding and political philosophic commitment, the idea that slavery is wrong, the idea that women are to be equal citizens, the idea that the people are the ultimate source of sovereignty, the idea that political speech should be protected in the interest of the maintenance of an open and a free a context for communication between people as they try to govern themselves, the idea that there should be a robust and independent press that has the capacity to criticize the actions of powerful people without fear of being murdered or dispossessed or whatever it might be. All of these are road signs of progress along the way for Western political institutions.
So does that mean that if Rush Limbaugh calls Sandra Fluke a slut, that he should be allowed to keep doing what he does and that there should be no calls for his being fired? Because this is what this plays into, free speech.
Well, no. I mean, I think that's a confusion with respect. I mean, I think it's the action of the state that we're talking about here.
Okay.
If people boycott Chick-fil-A because they don't like what the chief executive officer said, if people turn their radio dials away and advertisers decide that they no longer want to support a particular talk show host because he's offensive or crude or ignorant or whatever it might be, of course they have the right to do that. I don't have to invite you to my dinner party if I think that you're an asshole. Mm-hmm. And if you say things that cause me to think that you're an asshole, I'm not going to invite you to my dinner party. That's not an infringement upon your free speech.
Right.
That is simply the social consequences of people hearing you speak in a particular way. And it's true that that kind of anticipated sanction might induce some people not to say what they think. That's called political correctness, in my view. People don't always say what they think because they know it will be unpopular and they don't want to be seem to be unpopular. No. What I'm talking about is the action of the state and the fact that the person has a legal right protected by the institutions of the state to express themselves openly even when they voice unpopular opinion. And that the role of the state is not to get into, the content of that opinion. It's right or it's wrong. We agree or we disagree. But to continue to protect and, sustain an institutional environment in which the expression of that opinion can take place in an unfettered manner. And I think we have achieved that to a very high degree in the West. And I think that's a tribute to the quality of this political dispensation that we enjoy in the West.
I agree with you, but there's a part of me that worries that we're talking about legions and legions of people. Oh, folks, in terms of blogging heads' pets, what you are seeing right now is Clancy, the cat, and I'm getting rid of him. Glenn, my cat's on my lap, sir.
That's all right, John. I don't mind. So I don't have anything comparable over here.
That's Clancy, right, folks. Anyway, I agree, but there's so very many people, and many of them are professors and deep thinkers, who just can't handle that aspect of things. And I think here in the United States, we have a lot of trouble with it, too, when it touches on what we consider a lot of our sacred cows, the sense that, well, you just can't say that words matter, that words hurt. We almost start to question our ideals, and there are people here who were told, haven't you heard of the First Amendment? And the general sense that, well, there must be certain places where the First Amendment can't apply because I'm just hurting so badly. And so I get it, but it also just seems to me that they're not going to change their mind, and we have an internet. And so things are going to keep on being said because there's a certain kind of person who's a professional provocateur. And so do you see any possibility of a dialogue? Because certainly it isn't that we tell the people on the streets now in those countries, you have to understand that we do things differently from you. Because their response is, well, you shouldn't. And it just stops there.
The answer is yes. I see a chance. I mean, not in a heated moment like this. okay? But over the longer term, I do see a chance for a dialogue. I think there are many forces of moderation within Islamic civilization broadly understood. I think Indonesia is very different, and Indonesia or Malaysia are very different than Saudi Arabia, okay? I think that as the history of the West reveals, dealing with the challenge of modernity is difficult, and it takes a very long time. I think that the Islamic societies are behind us in a certain sense that could be made rigorous in dealing with the implications of the modern world, which has shrunk, which is pluralistic, in which half of humanity, that is the female half, are going to be heard from, and all the rest. I think they're behind us, but I don't see any reason to conclude that, again, broadly speaking, they can't get there.
It'll be a while, but yeah.
I had the wonderful experience some years ago of participating in a dialogue with some Islamic scholars that was organized by this guy at the Institute for American Values in New York City, David. I may think of his name, so I'm sorry, I can't think of his name. Anyway, he's a maybe mildly right-of-center culture entrepreneur type guy who created this institute in New York that has had a certain success in a relatively small scale. And he organized an Islam West conversation after the outbreak of the Iraq War back in 2003, and brought some people from North Africa and the Middle East and whatnot, together with some people like myself from North America, a few people from Europe, and we sat around a table for a few days on the island of Malta and bandied about, do we have anything to talk about? And this included journalists from, you know, Syria and relatively liberal Muslim scholars from, you know, Tunisia and Morocco, and there was someone from Oman and places like that. I was impressed with the extent to which the people that I met there were deeply read in the literature of political theory and political philosophy of the West, and were deeply committed to struggling toward the creation of open societies in the countries where they live. Now, they didn't agree, you know, with the American sensibility about a whole lot of stuff, okay, especially about Israel and our role in that conflict in Palestine. But on the whole, I came away thinking that these were people that I could communicate with and could talk to, and that there was a lot of common ground. Now, they were a minority. They are a minority within the societies, and they have an uphill struggle, and it may be three steps back for every step forward for a while. But it's not like there's no there. That was my sense.
I hope that's correct. Glenn, I think we have to close down.
Yeah, I think we have to go too.
For today.
Great, John. Thanks again.